There are two views of Christmas, two ways to sing the Christmas gospel, and Christmas is a sung gospel, a sung psalter, a sung liturgy, a sung word of grace. There are two perspectives upon Christmas by which we may view today's gospel lesson. We may look at and toward Christmas by looking down, down to depth, down to ground, down to root, down to past. We may look up, up to height, up to horizon, up to blossom, all to the future. Both are blessed, both are glad tidings of great joy. First, we sing the Christmas gospel from memory, whether from the day of Herod the king or from the first day, which is for the rest of life, this morning itself. Just a few days ago, a friend of mine and I went to the Hattie Cooper Mission in near Roxbury on a nicer day, though it would be a long walk. You could walk from Marsh Chapel there. More than 100 years ago, a minister's wife in that neighborhood began a mission to needy children in a tough neighborhood. And we went, and we were greeted by four-year-olds who had been made conscripts to music for visitors, and they stood to sing, and we sat in little kindergarten chairs. They gave us name tags with a star. You remember how important it is to have a star. And they sang one and another. They concluded with, "He's got the whole world in his hands." Do you know how many verses there are to that song? There are 200, and we heard them all. And I listened as each concluded, as a sparkling young man in the back row would lean forward. The choir master didn't hear him at all, but he was saying something. And with each verse, he said the same thing, so I couldn't quite make it out. You know, he's got everybody, brother and sister, sun and moon, wind and rain. But after each one, curling his hands in a cradle, the boy would say, "What about the itty-bitty baby?" And the song ended and the music was over, and he stammered prophetically and said, "What about the itty-bitty baby?" So we sang verse 201. "He's got the itty-bitty baby in his hand." We sang, as he did, from memory. This is our mother tongue. It is the language in which we have been formed, we have been raised, and we have been grown. It is the language of memory. It's so important to enact and reenact, come Christmas, this gospel memory, as we do. You know, not many nights ago, now they've all gone off to their own homes, but a dozen undergraduates gathered to trim this tree before you in the chapel. Isn't it beautiful? It is. They came, one from Southern California, one from Minnesota, one from Texas, one from New York, one from Florida, one from Pennsylvania, and others, and they stepped through the depth, ground, root, memory of Christmas. There is a way to sing the Christmas gospel from memory. There is a depth to Christmas. Christmas is the explosive impulse of lasting good. And that's what we remember. It's important. It's saving for us so to remember. Because a deep recession is not as deep as the Christmas impulse for a lasting good. A deeply searing swindle is not as deep as the Christmas impulse for a lasting good. A deeply mistaken warfare is not as deep as the Christmas impulse for a lasting good. And the anxious, dark, deep worry over disemployment, unemployment, reemployment is not ever finally, erasingly as deep as the Christmas impulse for a lasting good. We remember. We know. We look down in this sense, looking down past into the long forgotten years. We know that hearing our gospel, Paul himself, our earliest record in the Christian scriptures, has no mention of the miraculous birth. In all of his letters, he mentions it not simply. He says, born of woman, born under the law. Our earliest gospel, Mark, has no record of any of this, which we've heard before. Matthew and Luke themselves, where they share material, have no record of such. It's only other than the reading today, Matthew 1:18, that records the miraculous supernatural. And there, Matthew is providing an exegesis, as you know, of Isaiah 7:14. A virgin shall conceive and bear a child, and his name shall be called Emmanuel. And whether Matthew's interest was more historical, theological, or exegetical, we shan't know. But Luke's interest, strange to our ears, is other than first we might think. In our time, we hear these words thus. We wonder about the supernatural entering the natural. We wonder about God entering a womb. We wonder about the divine entering the human. And while Luke, with his time, there are multiple accounts of such births in the ancient world, had that as an interest, his core focus is otherwise. For Luke, the question is not Jesus' divinity. That's our question. For Luke, the question is Jesus' humanity. And here, and particularly in the passages that will come, Luke's interest is in making sure to secure Jesus born of Mary. Jesus is our childhood's measure. Jesus is our childhood's measure. Day by day, like us, he grew. He was little, weak, and helpless. Tears and smiles, like us, he knew. And he feeleth for our sadness, and he shareth in our gladness. That's Luke's interest in the humanity of Jesus. And absent a suddenly discovered first century hospital report of a portentous birth, we have no way of knowing what may or may not have happened. And that's not Luke's point anyway. This account, like the resurrection itself, is a call to faith, not a proof of faith. It is invitation, not documentation. It is an invitation for you, for us, to live daily with the sure faith that in every situation there is present a Christmas impulse for a lasting good. You salt, you light, you live it. Here you are, and here you are listening from afar. You know, you might say along with me that the lastingly good things in life have all been the gifts of grace of God in the person of Jesus Christ. I make this testimonial. Name given in baptism. Faith is always a gift given in confirmation. Community in Eucharist. Friendship, partnership, deep love in marriage. Vocation, employment in ordination. Pardon needed by day and by decade in forgiveness. Such a living sacrament. And especially hope for this life and for the next, all given. This is Christmas sung from memory, in which we are grounded, in which we find the ground of our being, in which salvation is ground out in fear and trembling. And yet, you may sense, as I do, that this passage is not completed with the past and memory. Yes, all of the aforementioned is true, but isn't there something further? There are two ways to view this passage. There are two perspectives on Christmas, one from the past and the ground and the root and depth, and another out of the future, out of the height, out of the horizon of all that is yet to be. I ask you this. What if the language of Christmas is not that which already we have learned our mother tongue? What if Christmas is the language into which we are leaning, the tongue we are only lisping. What if we stand not atop Christmas, but beneath Christmas? What if we are stretching like you stretched toward that garret door in your grandmother's ceiling that you always wanted to enter? What if we are like a toddler learning for the first time, as a toddler does, the first words, moon, boat, no, boat, moon, boat, no. What if that's where we are at Christmas? Reaching up to say something that we don't know yet the grammar, the syntax, the spelling, the language. Several nights ago, I heard, speaking of angelic voices, the elementary choir of the Learning Project Elementary School singing winter songs of love and acceptance in the Emmanuel First Baptist Church on Commonwealth Avenue. The plaque to my right was of Obadiah Holmes in the 1600s. You may not remember Obadiah, but his plaque says he was whipped in the city of Boston. His crime? Baptist beliefs. And as I looked at his plaque and heard the music, I wondered whether 400 Christmases ago or so, there were a woman or a man or more than one wondering about a day when distinctions in Protestant doctrine would not be whipping crimes in Boston. And I wondered, looking 400 years ahead, or maybe it's 40, could it be 4? When there might come a day when distinctions in religious doctrine would not be causes for terror the world over because of the itty-bitty baby. This is the hope of peace on earth, not in spite of the scandal of particularity of Jesus Christ, not in spite of his particular story, his poor birth, his teaching and healing, his rude death, his wondrous resurrection, not in spite of, but because of. This is God's way in the world. Christmas is the simple restatement of what is. Not what could be or should be or might be or would be if we'd work it through, but simply by God. What is. Our students at Boston University gave us a religious experience of the Christmas gospel some days ago, gave me such. I don't know what the rule book says about middle-aged preachers and whether or not one in such a condition is still open to and able to have such a religious experience. I hope I qualify because, in fact, it did happen. And it happened here in this beautiful nave in the dark of a Friday evening. You know, middle age, the age of failing eyesight and receding hairline and scattergun memory and hardening arteries and opinions is just the season in which one should ought. Might possibly have such an experience, and it came in the least likely of seasons. This was just following the Mumbai tragedy. Earlier that week, two of our Jewish communities had gathered together for a serene and reverent memorial on the plaza. And then some nights later, we received a call. Could 16 South Asian student groups gathered together on Friday at 6:30 p.m., similarly to remember, similarly to pray, would the dean greet them? In we came on that dark night. I mentioned Lincoln here in our window and his words, "The dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate to the stormy present. The occasion is piled high with difficulty, and we must rise," now hear that, rise, look up, a new language. "We must rise with the occasion. Our situation is new, and so our action and speech must be new as well. We must disenthrall ourselves from what has been, and so we will save our," he said, "country." I said, "world." And then, having greeted, I took a seat in the back pew. I like sitting in the pew. That has a future. I'm looking forward to that. And darkness fell. The service began at 6:45 and ended at 7:03. 18 minutes. Silence, prayer. Silence, speech. Silence, candles. Silence, singing. Silence, standing silence. Hindu, Jain, Sikh, Muslim. And one said, the leader of the Islamic Society said, it is up to us. We must stand and be counted as those who will not countenance this kind of violence, or we shall lose our humanity. And then standing silence, and then 16 candles lit, one for each group, and then something about 320-year-olds reverent in the quiet dark. It is a young world singing a new song, the Christmas promise that our distinctions need not be our downfall, that our distinctions need not be our downfall. And by the end of those few 18 minutes, though they were lastingly eternal, I was overcome. There were four speakers. They spoke for 3 minutes, not each. Their total was 3 minutes. There was an Indian national hymn at the end. And what was it that overcame? Had there been an altar call, I would have come forward. And in a way, there was. What was it? The dark dusk facing a darker mystery? The portent of courage in young voices? The barely visible admiration of Jesus and his gospel writers, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, looking down in admiration of what was being said? The fact that this chapel was being used precisely, exactly, as its founders intended, as a place where distinction does not become downfall, but common ground, common faith, common hope withstand all. The capacity to hear a new song, given and received, all in the eternal brevity of 18 minutes. There are two ways to view the Christmas gospel, both glad and both good, to look down and look back at depth and ground and root, to look up and look out at an open, unforeseen future where our distinctions need not be our differences. It was the music of the duet Daniel Marsh and Howard Thurman sang together 50 years ago, both of them already 100 years ahead of their time. We're 50 years behind them still. When the song of the angels is stilled, and the star in the sky is gone, and the kings and princes are home, and the shepherds are back with their flocks, then the work of Christmas begins. To find the lost, to heal the sick, to visit the stranger, to rebuild the nations, to bring peace among brothers, to make music in the heart. Sing we now of Christmas.